Okay, so let's unpack this. When you and I use the word dignity in just, casual conversation, what are we actually talking about?
Right. It's usually this very soft, fuzzy thing.
Exactly. It's an emotional state, like it's feeling respected, it's a vibe. You leave a bad meeting and say, "Well, I kept my dignity."
Yeah, it feels entirely subjective. It's often treated as a sentiment, sort of the user experience of being human.
Right. But today we are looking at the stack of notes on the 18th century philosopher Immanuel Kant, and what is wild and frankly a little jarring is that for him, dignity isn't a feeling at all.
Not even a little bit.
It has absolutely nothing to do with your emotions or your self-esteem. It is this rigorous, hard-coded architectural constraint for how human beings interact.
And that is the perfect way to frame it. If you're building a system, whether that's a society, a legal framework, or an AI algorithm, dignity isn't a UI feature.
Right, it's not the wallpaper.
No, it's not the dark mode that makes things look nice.
Yeah.
It's the kernel. It's the fundamental, non-negotiable rule that dictates how the system is allowed to process a human user versus, say, how it processes a line of code or a piece of hardware.
And the mission for this deep dive is to move way past that dictionary definition. We want to understand dignity technically. Like, how do we define it so precisely that we could theoretically explain it to an algorithm?
Which is incredibly hard to do.
It is. And more importantly, and this is where the research gets really sticky for you listening, how does that technical definition create massive friction when we try to apply it to the messy reality of the real world?
Well, it creates friction because Kant's definition is absolute. It doesn't care about context, and it sure as hell doesn't care about utility.
No, it doesn't.
And that leads to some incredibly counterintuitive conclusions. I mean, we're going to get to a point later in this deep dive where we discuss a paradox, where under this strict definition, a murderer might actually want to be executed.
Oh man, the murderer paradox. I read that section of the sources three times. It completely flips the script on how we think about mercy and justice. It sounds insane at first
It
glance.
really does. But you can't understand the execution until you understand the code that requires it.
So let's lay that foundation. Let's look at the binary code of dignity. The source material highlights three conceptual pillars here. The first one is that dignity is inalienable.
Right.
Now, in property law, alienable means I can sell something or give it away. My car is alienable. My time is alienable. I mean, I sell it to my boss every day.
You do. But Kant argues that dignity is hard-coded into the hardware of being human. You cannot sell it. You cannot give it away.
So it's locked.
Completely locked. And this is crucial for system design. Even if a user comes to you and says, "Hey, I want to debase myself. I want to sign away my rights to be treated as a human for $1 million," the system has to say, "Error."
So even if I actively want to be a slave, the system just says invalid request.
Precisely. Because you don't actually own your dignity in a way that allows you to trade it. It's not an asset you hold, it's what you are. If you sell it, you cease to be the entity that the system recognizes as human. The attribute is permanently locked.
Which connects directly to the second pillar. It's indivisible. The source material uses a great analogy here that I think clears things up instantly. It compares dignity to being pregnant.
It's a binary state, zero or one. You're either pregnant or you aren't.
Right, there is no somewhat pregnant.
Exactly. And for Kant, you cannot have half dignity. This is a radical rejection of hierarchy. Think about a feudal system or even just a modern corporate ladder. We tend to think a CEO has more dignity than an intern.
Or that a saint has more dignity than a sinner. We definitely act like that in everyday life.
We absolutely do. But in this framework, the loftiest figure and the lowest criminal in a supermax prison possess the exact same amount of dignity. It's a status flag. If is human equals true, the value is absolute. It's infinite. You can't add to infinity and you can't subtract from it.
And that leads to the third pillar. It's universal. It applies to every instance of the human class. But okay, here is where I start to see the cracks in the theory.
Where's that?
If everyone has this status, this infinite value, how do we actually interact with each other? Because if I treat you with having infinite value, I can't really ask you to do menial tasks for me, can I? I mean, I can't ask a god to take out the trash.
That is the exact practical problem. If we walked around in a state of constant, paralyzed reverence for every human being we encountered, society would just grind to a halt.
Yeah.
You couldn't buy coffee because you'd be too busy honoring the barista's infinite soul to ask for a latte.
So how do we patch this? Because we really need coffee.
We have to split the definition. The source material breaks dignity down into two interfaces, There's the protective interface and the assertive interface.
Let's start with the protective side.
Okay, so this is a negative right. It is the right not to be treated merely as a tool.
Ah, this is the famous means versus ends distinction.
Correct. And to understand it, look at the difference between a coder and a computer.
Okay, walk us through that.
Imagine I run a software company. I buy a high-end server, and I hire a brilliant coder. Functionally, I need them both to do the exact same thing, process data and generate code. I'm using both of them to achieve my goal, but there is a critical difference in failure states.
Right. If the server blows a fuse or the motherboard fries, what do? I don't hold a funeral for it. I don't try to heal it. I replace it. It is a commodity.
Exactly. It is a tool. Its value is entirely derived from its function. If the function hits zero, the value hits zero. You toss it in the recycling bin and order a new one.
It says.
But if the coder breaks, let's say they get sick or they have a mental breakdown, I can't just toss them in the dumpster.
Well, legally you can't, and ethically you shouldn't. Although some companies might try.
They might try, but that's where the violation happens. Because the coder's value is intrinsic, not functional. Even if they never write another line of code, they retain that binary dignity status. They are an end in themselves. I have to send them to the hospital. I have to offer support. The system cannot discard them just because the output stopped.
The source material uses the analogy of a pen here, which I found really helpful for understanding a key term in all this. Fungibility. Can we unpack that?
Yes. Fungibility is a concept from economics. It basically means the ability to swap one item for another identical item without caring. If I need to sign a document and my pen runs out of ink, I throw it away and grab another one. Mm-hmm. I don't care which pen it is. They are indistinguishable commodities.
But humans are non-fungible?
Ideally, yes.
Yeah.
Even if you had two identical twins clones, basically, who are equally good at coding, you cannot simply swap them out and treat them as interchangeable units.
No.
You care about the specific individual. You can't tell a mother, hey, sorry, your son died. Here is an identical replacement who is just as good at math, so we're good.
But hold on. This is where the rubber meets the road, and where I think Kant gets really difficult to live by. The sources bring up the grocery store case. Because let's be honest, when I go to the grocery store, I have two options. I can use the self-checkout machine, or I can go to the human cashier.
And how do you treat the machine?
I don't care about it. If it breaks, I move to the next one. I don't ask it about its day. It's an object.
Right. And the human cashier.
If I'm being totally honest, 90% of the time, I treat them exactly like the machine. I just want my transaction processed. I don't want a deep conversation. I just want to use their labor to get my groceries and leave. I am using them as a means to an end. So am I violating their dignity?
This is the uncomfortable truth the sources highlight. To function in a complex society, we have to objectify people to some degree. We treat the bus driver like a bus driving object. We treat the cashier like a scanning object. If we had a deep, meaningful encounter with every person we met, we'd never get anything done.
So is Kant's framework broken? Are we all just constantly sinning against dignity?
Not quite. Kant offers a patch. He admits we use people. You need the cashier to scan the items. The violation only occurs if you use them exclusively as a tool.
So there's a loophole.
It's not a loophole, it's a constraint. You can use their labor, but you cannot think of them as the labor. Think of it like a computer process running in the background. In the foreground, you are interacting with the scanner function. But in the background, you are running the human protocol.
Okay, so how do I know if the background protocol is actually working?
You know it's working by what happens when the function fails. If the scanner machine breaks, you get annoyed and kick it. If the human cashier suddenly has a heart attack, do you step over them to scan your milk?
No, obviously I stop everything. I call 911. The human flag interrupts the cashier flag.
Precisely. That interrupt is the proof of dignity. That is the protective interface, the firewall that prevents us from commodifying each other completely. It's latent until it's needed.
Okay, so that's the shield. The protective interface stops us from being treated like disposable pens. But the sources talk about a second side to dignity, which I think is even more fascinating. The assertive interface.
Yes. If protective dignity is, don't tread on me, assertive dignity is, let me stand on my own two feet. It's the positive right to agency and accountability.
And this is where we get the baby distinction. This is a great litmus test for how we view people.
It really is. Imagine a baby steals a toy from another baby. What is her reaction? Do we arrest the baby? Do we call it a thief? Do we put it on trial?
No, we just say no and give the toy back. We don't judge the baby morally.
Why not?
Because it's a baby. It doesn't know any better. It lacks the capacity for intent. It's just running on instinct.
Exactly. We treat the baby as a creature of instinct, not a creature of reason. We manage it. We control it. But notice what that implies. To be treated with dignity is to be treated as an adult capable of error.
That's a powerful reframing. Usually we think of punishment as a bad thing. We want to avoid it. But here, the argument is that exempting someone from punishment is actually dehumanizing them.
Think about the phrase we use in heated arguments. Don't treat me like a baby. What are we actually demanding when we say that?
We're demanding the right to be held responsible. We're saying, my actions count.
Yes. We are saying, I am a rational agent. I made a choice. Deal with me as an equal, even if I was wrong. If you strip away the consequences of my actions, even out of kindness or paternalism, you are stripping away my dignity. You're demoting me from human to pet.
So agency and accountability are two sides of the same coin. You can't have the freedom to choose without the burden of the consequence.
Correct. And this brings us to the most radical application of this logic, the dissolving society thought experiment. This is pure Kantian rigor, and I have to warn you, it is pretty shocking to modern ears.
I love this scenario because it's so extreme. So set the scene for us.
Imagine a small island society, maybe 100 people. For whatever reason, they decide we're done. They are going to dissolve the state. Everyone is going to get on a boat and scatter to different parts of the world. The society will cease to exist tomorrow.
The state is over. No more government. No more future social contract. No one needs to be protected from anyone else because the group is disbanding.
Right. But there is one last piece of business.
Huh?
There is a convicted murderer sitting in the island prison awaiting execution. Now, the practical utilitarian view, the view most of us would probably take, is why bother?
Yeah, absolutely. We're leaving. Society is ending. Executing him serves no purpose. It won't deter future crime because there is no future society. It won't protect anyone because we're all splitting up. Just let him go or leave him there. Why add a body count to the dissolution? It feels barbaric to execute him for no practical reason.
But Kant argues that before the boats leave, the society must execute the murderer.
Why? Is it just blind adherence to the rules? Is it bloodlust?
No. It's about honoring the criminal.
Honoring the criminal by executing them. That sounds incredibly Orwellian. How is killing him an honor?
It sounds that way, but follow the logic of the assertive interface. If you say, oh, never mind, you can go, what are you saying about the murderer?
You're saying his actions didn't matter?
You are saying he isn't a rational agent.
Aye.
You are treating him like the baby who stole the toy. You are saying you couldn't help yourself, you poor thing. Off you go. You are reducing him to a thing that malfunctioned or an animal that acted on instinct.
So by executing him, you are validating his status as a human.
Precisely. You are looking him in the eye and saying, we believe you are a rational being who freely chose to commit this act. And because we respect your agency, we will apply the consequence that you logically chose. The paradox is that the murderer, as a dignified creature, theoretically wants the execution.
He wants it. That's a hard sell.
He should. Because it is the only way to validate his own humanity. It is the final stamp that says, I am a rational agent. I chose this. I am accountable. To let him go is to deny his humanity. It's the ultimate form of respect to take someone seriously enough to punish them.
That is heavy. It flips our modern understanding of mercy on its head. We usually think mercy is the dignified choice. Kant suggests mercy can be the ultimate insult.
Mercy can be paternalistic. It can be looking down on someone and saying, you're too weak to bear the weight of your actions. Dignity is looking them in the eye and saying, you did this. You carry the weight of it, even if that weight destroys you.
So if we zoom out and try to synthesize this back to our user versus code question, we have these two forces. We have the protective force, do not treat me like a lab rat or a tool. And we have the assertive force, let me make my own mistakes and pay for them.
And that synthesis is incredibly hard to maintain in the digital age. Look at how modern algorithms treat users. They often fail on both counts.
How so? Give me a concrete example.
We'll take the lab rat example from the notes, the OcCupid controversy, or their Facebook mood experiments. When a tech company tweaks a feed to manipulate your emotions just to see what happens, they are violating the protective dignity. You are being used as a tool for data.
Right. You're the pen. They are extracting value until you run dry.
But it also violates the assertive dignity. Because the system assumes you can't control yourself. It assumes you are a bundle of reflexes, like the baby, that can be nudged and manipulated by colors and notifications. It doesn't treat you as a rational agent capable of saying, I choose not to engage. It attempts to bypass your agency entirely.
It commodifies the user. It turns a subject into an object. It's the worst of both worlds. You're being used like a tool and you're being managed like a baby.
And that is the core of the danger. When we operationalize dignity, we are fighting against the tendency of systems to turn subjects into objects. Data is fungible. Humans are not. But it is much, much more efficient to treat humans like data.
This really clarifies why dignity is such a difficult constraint. It's inefficient. It requires us to keep the sick coder on payroll. It requires us to execute the murderer even when society is ending and it serves no utility. It requires us to treat the cashier as a complex soul when we just want milk.
It requires us to value the status of the human over the utility of the human. And in a world driven by utility, by optimization, speed, and profit, dignity is always going to be a drag on the system. It's a feature that slows everything down.
But it's the feature that makes us human.
Exactly.
So here's where it gets really interesting for you listening to this. We've looked at the binary code, the protective shield, and the lethal accountability of the assertive interface.
I think it forces us to reevaluate what we actually want from our systems and our societies. We often say we want dignity, but I don't think we realize the cost.
The cost being that we have to own our mistakes.
Yes, we like the protective part. Don't use me. But are we ready for the assertive part? Hold me responsible.
And that brings us to the final dilemma for this deep dive. Based on everything we've just discussed, we want to leave you with a choice.
It's a choice between two competing goods, social well-being versus human dignity.
Here's the scenario. Imagine you have to choose between two worlds. World A is the safe world. In this world, the systems, the government, the AI, the corporations, they treat you like a beloved child. They manipulate you, they nudge you away from bad choices, and they prevent you from harming yourself. You are safe, you are happy, but you are effectively a well-managed instrument. You are the baby.
Or world B, the dangerous world. In this world, you are treated with full Kantian dignity. You are never manipulated. You are free to make terrible, catastrophic mistakes. And if you cross the line, you face the full weight of the consequences. You are not safe, but you possess the lethal dignity of the murderer.
So which world do you choose? Safety of the nursery or the danger of the adult table?
A world where you are protected from yourself, or a world where you are honored enough to be destroyed by your own choices?
That's the profound question we're leaving you to explore on your own. Thanks for diving in with us.